This is The Shakeout.
The crowd's still there, still within striking distance. Bishop challenging, so and so. Close reach towards the finish line.
He might do it. Look at that guy. Look at Plant Zero.
Oh, my God.
There's Salazar. Can he have enough? Salazar kicking.
This has to be the greatest race of his life.
Welcome to the Queen of the Mountains episode. My name is Michael Doyle. I am the editor of Canadian Running Magazine. And with me today, we have web editor Sinead Mulhern. How you doing?
Hi, Michael. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. And I was just panicking a second ago because I was like, do I say welcome to the or this is the blah, blah, blah episode?
Oh, man. We've only done 20 some.
This is 21 or two, I think. Crazy. Time flies.
And hello, Tim, as well.
Oh, yes. And over here across from me, we have the other guy.
The other guy.
Staff writer.
Happy to be the other guy. Thanks for having me.
Sometimes he's the first guy.
Yeah.
Sometimes he is. Yes.
On today's show, we've got two exciting segments. First up, we chat with top Canadian ultra mountain queen of the mountains, Alyssa Saint-Laurent, who is in Chamonix, France. She is going to run the Ultra Trail Mont Blanc, which is kind of the Boston Marathon, as she said to us when we're chatting with her, kind of the Boston Marathon of trail running. It's really the biggest, baddest, craziest ultra race in the world, perhaps, in terms of like big deal ultra races. So we chat with her on location. She's about a week out before the race. It takes place on September 1st, and we will have lots and lots of coverage of that. We've already been doing profiles and whatnot on various Canadian athletes there. We're pretty excited about that. And our second segment, we are going to have a roundtable discussion about the fascinating, gripping Netflix documentary Icarus, which unpacks, well, it starts off by exploring the idea of how to get past, how easy it is to get past doping controls, sort of like supersize me for doping controls.
Oh, God.
A self-experimental documentary. But then the documentarian basically unearths the entire Russian doping scandal in the process and documents all of that. So we talk all about what we thought of the documentary in detail in the second segment. It's a lot of fun. And of course, our weekly recommendations. This week's episode is sponsored by Chronobar, a 100% non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, all-natural energy and recovery bar for endurance athletes. Over the last few years, Canadian Alyssa Saint-Laurent has become one of the most exciting ultra and mountain runners in the world. She is in Chamonix, France, where she will be competing at the Ultra Trail du Mont Blanc, which is kind of like the Boston Marathon of the ultra and mountain scene. We chatted with her from Chamonix over the phone. Alyssa, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, you guys.
So, Alyssa, first of all, tell us, where are you right now?
Right now I'm in France. I'm in Chamonix, the start of UTMB next week.
So you sort of had, like, from what I can tell, a summer of a lot of highs and lows where, on the one hand, it sounds like you've had some searching and moments of struggle with your racing, but you've also totally changed your life up and you've been just kind of like traveling around the world and running all these crazy places. Tell us a little bit about the last couple of months.
That is so true. So many highs and lows, like figuratively, literally. But overall, it's just been a high. Like you said, I've been just able to take the summer to just be out in the mountains. There has been some racing involved, and so far I haven't nailed a single one this year. And that does get tough on your psyche. It's mentally a little bit hard, but in the end, I'm still out here. I'm still able to travel. I've spent a few weeks in Colorado. I've been in Switzerland and France since the end of July, so a few weeks now. And that has trumped all that. That is why I do this, is to just be able to get out here in mountains wherever in the world I am.
So you've done a lot of kind of big races in the past, Western States. You were at Hard Rock, I think, pacing this summer. What does doing UTMB mean to you, and how big of a deal is it?
I mean, UTMB is a big deal pretty much for any mountain ultra runner. I mean, just the immensity of the course, the amount of people, the hype, the location, it's all very big. It's all pretty spectacular. So I was here last year with a bit of an injury going into it, and so my training was lacking between Western States at the end of the June to UTMB at the end of August, and I didn't have what it took to finish. I think I got about 110 kilometers in. So there is a little bit of like wanting to do it right this time. But just in general, the course is so beautiful. It suits me. I love these mountains, the Alps. There's just something so special about this place. So it's a lot of things, but it is a big deal for me to be here. I'm really honored to be a part of it, but it means a lot to me.
And in your training for this, why don't you kind of, I'm curious to know a little bit about like what it's sort of a typical training run might look for you, or if you can just kind of, for people who don't know the location very well, if you can kind of paint us a picture of what it looks like when you go for a run, how you plan for it, etc.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you use the word run loosely here because you're basically in the bottom of this valley, and at some point you have to go straight up. There's nowhere really else to go. Like, it, obviously, it draws me up higher. So it's difficult to have a typical day here because there's just so many places to go. I don't feel like I've gotten into a routine, which is a bonus, which is
That's great.
I mean, I've definitely tried to add some structure into my training and not just have, you know, little like days skipping through the Alps. There's definitely been a lot of days like that, but, you know, I've done some intervals up hills and worked on my downhill and, you know, worked on the skills that I would be doing in the more mundane places that most people are training for their ultra marathons in. But, you know, I'll just... I'm able to just get up, and basically anywhere you go, you're going to climb about 1,000 meters to get any sort of views and heights, and anywhere from like 5 to 7 kilometers is, and then from there you can traverse over to the next mountain and to the next pass. Mm-hmm. Really, you could go as far as your legs will take you around here. It's amazing.
So Alyssa, you were an accountant for a while. I know you sort of decided to change things up with your career, but tell us a little bit about, like, take us back a few years, and tell us a little bit about how you got into ultra running.
Yeah, I didn't really mean to. I grew up in the mountains near in southern Alberta near Waterton Park, just right outside the park gate. So I spent, you know, all my time out there in the mountains. It was a very natural place for me to be. My family is very outdoorsy. Most of them ride horses as opposed to running like I do. But so when I started running casually, socially with friends, with people in Edmonton, doing some marathons, suddenly I found myself in trails, and then suddenly I realized that ultra marathons were a thing. This existed, and, you know, training for the marathons, the typical distances that you do with the long runs, were always my favorite days. You know, those 35 kilometer days that you do training for the marathon, I loved those days. So the distance suited me kind of right off the bat, just the long. I'm built for endurance for sure. So when I found out that ultra marathons existed, I mean, sign me up, I'm there.
What's the last year or so look like for you? Can you just kind of run us through some of the races you've done, maybe dating back to Western States last year?
oh, we're going to do this. No, that's okay. So Western States was a dream race for me last year. I mean, there's usually something you'd like to go better. And of course there was that day, but I was pretty happy with my fifth place finish there. Western States was my first 100 miler 2 years previous. So I moved up from 13th to 5th and knocked a couple hours off my time, which was awesome. And, you know, to be in the top 10 at Western States is kind of a big deal. Western States is one of the biggest 100 milers out there. It's very iconic. I respect that race a lot. So to be there was awesome. To do well was even better. But after that race, I tried to kid myself that I was okay, that I just needed a few days of recovery. But I was limping. I couldn't walk properly. I had something wrong with my hip. I'm still not sure exactly what that was. So I tried to run probably one more time in all of July, and it took a lot, getting through a lot of pain. So, you know, I didn't have a lot of running last summer. And so going into TMB, I came here a few weeks before the race last year, and I was still limping getting onto the plane. So going in to such a big race, this was bigger than anything I'd done, I was very unsure. And I think that showed when I dropped it 110 kilometers in. You know, it was, most of it felt good, but the parts that didn't, they broke me. They broke me mentally. So luckily, a few weeks later, I was able to use that training that I'd crammed in for UTMB, and I went down to Colorado for Run Rabbit Run. It's a 100 miler down there, and I was able to pull it together, and I got a second place finish, which I was really happy about. And so I kind of ended the year on that higher note and didn't race again until February of 2017, where I got an invite to run the Tarawera 100K with the Ultra Trail World Tour. And you know, I was pretty fit for the middle of winter. I thought I was all right. I made a point of going down about 10 days before the race to get some heat training in, to, you know, see so much of, like, my drive for all of these bigger races now is the travel with it and just seeing the places that's become really important to me. Mm-hmm. So I was able to cram a lot of running and training and heat into that trip, but definitely too much, because I landed myself in the hospital a little under halfway through that race with some kidney problems, some dehydration issues.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was not fun. It was a scary day, but I was able to recover from that after a few weeks, and picked a race, another race. Really just did not suit me. The Lake Sonoma 50 mile down in California.
Right.
It's a fast, competitive field. And, you know, I thought I could maybe hold on to a top 10 spot there, but I ended up tearing a quad muscle fairly early in the race. And I know, right? Like, I just think back on all these things. That's the things about ultramarathons, like, not to mention the weather, the distance of food, your stomach, that just so many factors that can go wrong, the injuries that come with putting the big mileage for these big races in. You know, it's one thing to get to a start line healthy sometimes, so there are a lot of factors. You kind of have to have a short-term memory and learn from it and move on and not let these defeats or not non-finishes, whatever you want to call it, just can't let it get you down.
Yeah. So it's been a good year, is what you're saying. Glad right. that we just made you rehash all of that.
I knew we were going to have to. It's okay. It's part of the story now. They make better stories than, oh, I had a good day and finished well. I probably could do better next time, but for now it was good enough.
Well, that's part of it, right? You know, I find ultra running and trail running so fascinating, and I don't do it. But I'm curious to know, so when you start running and you're living in southern Alberta in your 20s, mm-hmm. How do you kind of get into that? There's a lot of like more planning, different things that you have to keep in mind. We've gone over like some of the health and injury stuff and just getting to races, planning differently, all the travel. There's a lot that goes into it. Did you have any kind of like mentors in the sport or figures who you looked up to in that scene or people who kind of like guided you through and showed you the ropes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was lucky to fall in with a good group of runners in Edmonton. They're run out of the Fast Tracks ski and run shop there. They all kind of meet. We at least twice a week minimum and run out of the shop. And you know, you can meet so many people through these groups, but they've got a good ultra community there. And so a lot of these people definitely introduced me to ultras and kind of helped me like figure out just from like going to the shop and being like, oh, I'm running this race, what kind of shoes do I need? And it just seems so silly to ask those kind of questions now, but that's how it starts for everyone. You don't know. So just asking very these runners on runs, and you know, you get talking. Mm-hmm. And you can basically, they'll tell you anything you want to know. So, but yeah, just a lot of people through the Fast Tracks community there in Edmonton, for sure. That's how I really got roped into it.
So I was in Chamonix last June and did some running there and did that vertical kilometer climb. If I'm not mistaken, I saw you posted a picture on Instagram on that same course. Tell us a little bit about, I think for those who've maybe never been to Chamonix or run in the Alps before, tell us a little bit about the town and about kind of the atmosphere around this race. And also just sort of more generally, like what going out and running in the mountains around there is like, because it's sort of like one of the great places in the world for that.
It is. It is one of the great mountain outdoor places in the world. I mean, there's so much more going on here than just running, but that is a big part of it, especially now as we get closer to the race, we see more runners, racers. But there's definitely a big mountaineering culture. I've been camping here with a lot of people getting to like climb Mont Blanc and taking, you know, a few days and working their way up the refuges. It's all very accessible here, the mountains. It's such a cornerstone of any sort of mountain activities. You know, there's climbing, but the running, like you said, it's intense. The trails, basically anywhere in the valley, you can just find a trail that'll take you up the mountain. And some of them are fairly rough, but they're all quite established. You never feel like you're completely lost. It's really nice. It's a really great place to go to get a good mountain experience. Yeah, I've done that vertical kilometer a few times now. It's something.
It's kind of scary.
It's 1,000 meters, and yeah, it is. You get up to near the top. You're basically just following a line where the gondola goes up and switchbacks, just back and forth, ping-ponging your way up a steep slope. And then you get to the point where there's ropes and ladders and footholds that you have to be pretty precise. I don't think there's any sort of danger element, but it kind of makes you feel like there is.
Yes, so
it's definitely an exciting little climb.
So we're 1 week out from the race. What are you going to be doing between now and race day, just knowing that you've got most of your training in?
yeah, there's not a lot left I can do that's going to be beneficial. So I'll run for enjoyment and just to feel and do a lot of resting and visiting with friends and meeting new people and being part of the festivities. You know, there's other races that start before UTMB, so I'll be able to watch the racers there and get a little inspiration from the crowd, the energy. But it's, yeah, as far as running, I mean, I'm definitely going to be going out a little bit this week, but it's done. I can rest now, knowing I've done all that I've that I can this year, and that I'm healthy and I'm prepared. It's a nice feeling.
So, and finally, Alyssa, you've said you chatted with Tim earlier. We've got an interview we're going to post on our site. I think we've actually already posted it today. And you said yeah, it's great. Everyone listening should read it. It's fantastic and goes into some depth about what we've talked about here. And you said you're going to be racing for place, not so much for anything else. How is it over the course of over 100 miles in the mountains? Like, how do you stay focused and like, how do you emotionally, how do you kind of like, how do you dole that out over the course of a day trying to race for place?
You know, it's surprisingly easy. I kind of take on a bit of a different persona when I on race day. I don't know where she comes from, but she's there. She doesn't come out very often. but for a race like that, she'll be there. You can't get too worked up too early, especially with the crowd that's going to be here. I mean, we've got 2,000 runners maybe that are starting, and European races, they go out fast, and this first 8 kilometers of this race is very runnable. Some of it's on pavement and it's fast. They run it like they're not going to be running for a day or two. You just have to keep within yourself for a while before you start to get hungry and start to want to pick people apart, you know, hunt people down. That'll come. There'll be time for that. And I'm excited for that part of it. But until then, I need to take care of myself. I need to worry about myself. So the race doesn't start when the race starts. It starts long after that. And I know that. And I know a lot of things can happen over the course of a day. And I'm going to feel good at points and I'm going to not feel good. And I just need the patience to come out of that, because I do come out of that. Like, you know, I can I can handle a rough spot and still salvage my race. It's a long day, it's a long night. Those patience is a big part of it.
Well, we wish you good luck, and we'll be watching, and we'll actually have kind of wall-to-wall coverage of UTMB on our site. I think, if I'm not mistaken, and I apologize if I'm putting you on the place right now, but I think you were suggesting that you were going to do a little bit of an Instagram takeover for us at some point while you're there, if that's correct.
Yeah, I'm so excited.
Okay, good.
I can't wait to interact more with you guys. I'm so happy to have Canada behind me. I know, I've just had such great support for some of my other big races. So it's really motivating to have this whole country here behind me, you guys. I get a little patriotic. I'll have my little Canadian maple leaf on my hat, and I'm just proud to be a part of you guys.
Oh, well, we're excited. We're excited to watch how you do.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today.
I'll try to keep proud. Thank you.
Okay, let's back up one sec here. Were you the mastermind that cheated the Olympics?
Yes.
And that set off this whole chain of events.
Today, the World Anti-Doping Agency suspended Russia's sports drug testing lab.
99% of Russian athletes are guilty of doping.
It is an unimaginable level of criminality.
Now, the film Icarus, which is available streaming now on Netflix, is quite the story. We actually been covering the story sort of from the other end since all of this information started to leak out over the last couple of years. Sinead, I remember we've been talking about how we were covering the various press conferences and the New York Times reports and that sort of thing. How do you feel this film kind of encapsulated the whole doping scandal?
I think it did it justice. We have been following this basically since it broke, since German media broke it in 2015.
That's right.
And all the developments. I felt that, you know, it can be kind of a really complicated plot line to sort of just jump into because there's so much that has gone on. And without understanding the context, it can be really difficult to sort of like understand the characters, understand how this whole doping scandal started, how Russian anti-doping or lack thereof has worked for decades. So I actually felt that it's been hard to sort of explain this plot to someone. This did a really good job of getting all the essential pieces in and just walking through in a chronological order in a way that's not confusing too.
So we'll try to avoid, you know, outright spoilers. I don't know if it's something that you really can spoil at this point if you have been following the Russia doping scandal leading up to the Rio Olympics last year and beyond. So we'll just do a quick rundown, a synopsis of what Icarus is all about for those who've maybe not heard about it, but we won't really reveal any major spoilers, although I don't think there are a whole lot to reveal at this stage. It's been well reported. And if you're a fan of running, you've probably heard about, you know, Russia not being allowed to run at the athletics component of the 2016 Olympics. So filmmaker Brian Vogel in 2015 decided that he wanted to try to make a documentary about how easy it is to cheat anti-doping controls. He's a avid and pretty talented amateur cyclist. And so he was going to this kind of big amateur race, sort of they call it the Tour de France of amateur races, called the Haute Route in Europe. And so he wanted to find someone to help him cheat the doping controls or alleged doping controls there. He discovered that there weren't really that many doping controls there after all.
At all.
But it was an interesting, kind of an interesting experiment. He connected with a UCLA scientist who sort of had invented a lot of the anti-doping measures in the early 1980s and late 1970s. That guy got cold feet and he was handed off to a eccentric Russian guy who turned out to be the head scientist at RUSADA, the Russian anti-doping, or as we later discover, doping.
Doping program.
Doping program. This guy named Gregory Rodchenkov. And he's sort of the spine of the story. We follow him. And I mean, Vogel just sort of, in a sense, like all the great documentaries, he strikes gold. In an unexpected capacity. And Tim, how is it that he strikes gold in this sort of halfway through this talk?
Well, yeah, like you said, he met up with the UCLA guy who got cold feet, and then he kind of just right at the beginning of this whole WADA investigation got connected with this Russian guy, and everything kind of went from there. And you could just see every single time that something new popped up or some part of the investigation popped up, the main character, Brian, was just kind of shocked and worried about Gregory and basically his well-being, which is rather frightening. It just kind of escalated from the beginning when you couldn't really see that much coming, and it just got kind of bigger and bigger from there as more of kind of the cover-ups came to light.
I'd say like about 15 minutes to about halfway through the film, it sort of felt like a cool procedural where it was like they basically just Rodchenkov walked through how it is that you cheat the system, how you dope successfully in a lot of detail, actually. And you watch Vogel as he's, you know, taking testosterone and EPO and et cetera. And then, you know, how you kind of fix the urine samples and that sort of thing. And he even goes to Russia, and Roshenkov brings him into the Rusada lab. And so you see, get to see sort of behind the curtain there. And then everything goes crazy when this scandal starts to leak. And Roshenkov reveals that he's sort of been at the center of it all along, and that he is kind of he becomes the whistleblower, that and he has to escape to the United States, and Vogel is basically kind of orchestrating this escape, and they bring him to the U.S. They bring him to L.A., where he's sort of in hiding, and then they're trying to figure out what happens next, and that's when WADA gets involved. And we'll take a listen to a really quick clip, which is, I think, kind of one of the really the most tense moments in the film, where Vogel kind of Vogel representing Roshenkov goes to a WADA meeting in New York and explains to them the severity of what Roshenkov's going to reveal.
You know, we're 84 days away to the Summer Games in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil.
Until now, there's only really been hard evidence about athletics, but this is now pointing the finger at a whole range of sports.
As you guys all know, there's a Department of Justice investigation going. So Gregory's been advised by his lawyers he should not be here for security reasons. I worked with Gregory over about 6 months to compile record of what happened in Russia. This is the spreadsheet of every single athlete that was on the state-mandated protocol, what every single athlete was taking in London, including their sample numbers in collection. When Christiane goes back and tests these samples correctly, she will basically find them all positive.
So for me, Sinead, that scene is kind of one of the pivotal. I mean, there's a few really fantastic dramatic pivotal scenes in this documentary. And that's one of them, because you can tell, like, all of these people from WADA are just mortified.
Yeah.
I'm kind of actually amazed that they even agreed to go to participate in kind of the documentary, you know, like they got, Vogel got a lot of access to people, to everyone from every player, like talking to Richard Pound and, you know, the lead investigator, the independent investigators of this WADA investigation, everyone at WADA. And like, I felt like that scene was like the jaws were dropping, the scientists were getting emotional.
For sure.
Yeah.
To be honest, like, I'm amazed that he got that scene, that he talked to like the head honchos at WADA and the people who did this whole investigation, and that he even got like, the entire story is just jaw-dropping, that he even got this access. Like, he's got the top guy at Rusada. That's crazy. But this scene specifically, for me, when I was watching it, it did take me back to when these reports were all coming out. I mean, you can see the disbelief in their faces as they're starting to put together that Russia has actually been outsmarting the entire world this entire time. It's not like it was just the past couple Olympics. Like, as he puts it out in that scene, he's like, there was never any anti-doping control in Russia ever. And like, for me, it took me back to when this ball did drop, and like, everyone across the world realized like, this has been going on. And when we all just realized the level of corruption that has been going on, it was quite a shock. And for me, this scene embodied pretty much what everybody in media was thinking at the time that it broke.
So I think one of its great strengths, but also maybe a weakness to this documentary, is just how dramatically it is executed. It is very kind of slick at times. Some of the footage is quite beautifully done. It's really cleverly edited. It's actually kind of dramatically and emotionally a little bit manipulative. It sort of reminds me of this weird cross between like the Bourne Identity films, like the Bourne, you know, the Jason Bourne like action films, these conspiracy theory thrillers, mm-hmm. and the fantastic Edward Snowden documentary Citizen Four. Hmm. They like the tone, the music, the cutting, the conspiratorial aspect of it, sort of very similar to the to that film as well. Hmm. Did you, Tim? Did you like the film? Would you recommend the film to fans of running, to basically to anybody?
For sure, yeah. Like we deal with kind of the some of these doping stories on a weekly, if not daily, basis, especially last year. So
and you've admitted that you actually sort of have doping fatigue. You're sort of tired of this.
If I see a doping story, I usually don't even bother clicking on it because it just seems like the same old thing. But no, this was. First off, it was longer than I thought it. I think it's a 2-hour documentary. And I was expecting like an hour, maybe 90 minutes. But no, it was super interesting. A lot of stuff that I had no idea that was like they provided like a ton of cool visuals to kind of show the intricacies of kind of from Sochi, how they were able to evade these positive tests by bringing in, I won't spoil it, but I think it was like the Russian Secret Service was like helping out, and like just so many layers of corruption and so many layers of protection to try to catch the dopers that were just kind of evaded. Like it was rather incredible. And just kind of like learning about some of these characters and like actually having the players of this investigation in the documentary was super cool. Like like you guys said, Richard McLaren, the Canadian from I think Western University, and Richard Pound, like being in kind of the crosshairs of Brian while he was talking to Gregory, and just like he was kind of talking to both of them. I don't even know if Richard Pound or Richard McLaren knew that this guy was working with Gregory, like kind of this experiment.
That's the thing that still kind of mystifies me, and I'd love to know the answer to how it is that the filmmaker was able to wedge himself right in the middle of all so successfully, and not at some point just be pushed to the side and for the lawyers to handle this.
I know you would think that they would just be like, okay, you know too much.
Yeah,
that's enough with this documentary. Yeah. This is like the biggest scandal that we've seen in sporting history, basically ever. You, sir, can step aside now.
Yes, we'll handle
this. Is kind of top secret stuff. Like, yeah, he knows exactly what the New York Times is going to break before they break it.
Well, he is the one who's like delivering the breaking story to them.
And he's right in the middle of it. I was quite shocked by that too. It's like, how come you're just allowed to know all this stuff and continue to just be here? Like, who even are you?
I mean, it's no wonder. Apparently when this was shown at, I believe, the Sundance Film Festival last year, people were losing their minds over it and everyone wanted to have a piece of it. And I believe Netflix paid a crazy amount of money to get first rights to it. So this was something that was released not long ago on Netflix, and is available to stream at any time. And we highly recommend it. And it's
totally,
I mean, if you're a fan of global politics,
let's just say the doping scandal,
the state of the sport, the state of sports in general, big questions about sports. I think Dick Pound at one point says, you know, basically if all sport is fixed, what's the point of watching sport? Yeah. I think it's a pretty powerful statement.
Yeah. And I agree with that.
Them like comparing the medal haul that Russia got at these, like at the kind of corrupt Olympics was rather incredible. Like compared to Vancouver or Rio, they didn't get any, obviously, in athletics because they weren't there. But, it was kind of just like a spike at Sochi and then kind of crashing back down.
And tying that spike into Vladimir Putin's popularity in Russia and the importance of that and kind of the leverage that he has when he has that popularity and then the subsequent, encroachment or invasion into Crimea and, with the conflict with the Ukraine, sort of kind of creating a bigger world picture about how the Olympics is being leveraged in the hearts of minds of the average Russian citizen, and then all of the massive potential corruption that's involved and like assassination plots. Two people were murdered during this process. And I think
like FBI agents came to the guy's house.
Near the end. I know.
I was like, oh, that's weird.
we won't ruin too much, but yeah. the I'd say the last 30 minutes of this documentary are pretty intense.
Yeah, I really didn't have any criticisms of the documentary. I thought it was great. I'm kind of like, when the doping stories, when the headlines do come out, I'm totally the person who's clicking on them and trying. And a lot of them are repetitive, but I'm still like, I keep an eye on every detail. So for me, this was just like the coolest movie to nerd out about. I loved it.
I don't think it's completely over yet. I think obviously there's... you know, Russia has continued to deny that they have a problem or that they've had a problem. And one of the sort of thematic through lines of the documentary is the use of George Orwell's 1984.
Yeah, I thought that was cool.
And they have Rodchenkov like reading passages from it, which I thought was quite from a kind of narrative standpoint, very, very creative. And also telling of kind of the situation and attitude towards politics and truth in a country like Russia.
And it is funny, you know, 2.5 years later, or two and some years later after this has, or after the first parts of this scandal have come to light. I remember when this was first happening, and like that scene that we kind of referenced, it was a huge jaw drop and everyone was like not able to believe just the intricacies of how much of this has been fixed. And now it's like, you look at it from that sort of political standpoint. And back then we were sort of like amazed that this could filter all the way up to Putin. And then you watch this documentary and it's like, oh yeah, the KGB had a big part in it. And so did Vladimir Putin. Now it's just like, well, of course, like, of course it was. Like, I don't even know how this caught us off guard in retrospect. Now looking back, we can kind of say that. But, and yeah, I think there's going to be so much more that does come to light. This is going to be an ongoing thing for sure.
I think it's telling that a country that has issues with corruption, which was then able to host an Olympic Games, was motivated to win more medals at any cost at those Olympic Games for a variety of political reasons. I think it says things about kind of the nature of the Olympics right now, where the Olympics are being placed, the pressure, and also the opportunistic political opportunism at these games when they're held in these countries.
Mm-hmm.
It asks a lot of tough questions.
It makes you a cynic.
Makes you cynic, but you know, there. I do say that, like, for example, at the World Championships, last month or earlier this month, rather, the times were not as fast. The finishes were varied. I'm starting to wonder if maybe the doping programs, the more aggressive doping programs that are being enforced by WADA and by various countries around the world, are kind of getting serious and things are changing.
Hmm.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I'm not sure either. But I think... one thing is for certain, it seems pretty clear that WADA is sort of kind of tilting at windmills a little bit when it comes to battling the doping situation worldwide. And there's a lot of ways to cheat the system and never get caught. Like, that was pretty clear in the first 45 minutes of this documentary.
Oh, absolutely.
That you can dope out of competition, and as long as you're not going to get, you know, randomly tested, you're pretty free and clear to dope through all your training and then come off the doping, come off your doping regimen for competition, you know, test negative, you're clean and you race like a champ.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty disheartening.
Yeah, for sure.
But watching this documentary, thumb up, yes.
Oh, totally.
Thumb
up, yeah.
Thumbs way up. I highly recommend.
Three to six thumbs up.
If I had for six thumbs, they would all be up.
Yes. All right. So again, this week our sponsor is Chronobar, the Canadian-made, Montreal-based energy and recovery bar company. Tim, the Chronobar, we've eaten them. What are your thoughts?
The Chronobar is the lazy runner's meal, which I usually am in terms of cooking stuff right after a run or even before. So... if I had the choice to put anything in a bar form, it would probably be the contents of the Chrono Bar.
It's kind of like what I would blend in my Vitamix, but but then have no idea how to not make a shake and actually turn into something I can bring with me, not in a bottle.
You and your Vitamix.
My obsession.
I know. Bringing mixes or like shakes just anywhere, it just doesn't seem viable. So bringing it in a bar form, and it just feels like heartier at that point.
Yeah.
Getting in solids rather than solids in liquid form. So.
And for those concerned, they are gluten-free. They are 100% non-GMO, and they are made in Canada, and they started in Montreal. In fact, one of our contributing editors, John LaFranco, was telling me that he, a couple of years ago, had the opportunity to eat like the prototype of the Chrono Bar from the founder of Chrono Bar. She made them in her kitchen and like served them to him. Was like, what do you think? He was like, yeah, let's do this.
That's awesome. That's good.
Yeah.
I have a story about Chrono Bar.
You do?
Man, I do.
Tell us a Chrono tale.
My Chrono tale. One time, Chrono Bar saved me in a storm.
Go on.
I was in a kayak, kayaking down the Humber River.
The mighty Humber in Toronto.
I checked the weather forecast beforehand. I ignored it. Storm set in when I was halfway through, right at the mouth of the lake, and I had to hide under a bridge. At that point, I got really hungry. What did I happen to have in my backpack?
Oh.
A Chrono Bar.
Ah. So in the hours you were stranded in downtown Toronto in a kayak.
Mm-hmm.
You had a Chrono Bar to save.
Powered
today.
My muscles. I paddled right back up that river.
Well, that's kind of good.
Yes.
Always bring a snack. You never know. And now it is time for our weekly recommendations. Sinead, you're first up. What are you going to recommend this week?
Okay, my recommendation is some reading material. We featured Malcolm Gladwell on the website this week. Malcolm Gladwell, Canadian writer, also a very avid runner. He likes to make that known.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite piece by him is called The Ketchup Conundrum. It's a piece about ketchup. He basically asks the question, why are there so many different types of mustard that we eat, but when you go to the grocery store, generally there's just the Heinz ketchup, and
knockoff version of Heinz. Yeah.
Yeah. His question. How come there's one ketchup, but there's so many different types of mustard? And it's a good question, and he unpacks it in thousands of words in a New Yorker article. It's fantastic.
He finds a way to entertain you over 10,000 words.
About ketchup. Yes. And it's actually good. It sounds like a ridiculous topic because it is. It's amazing. It's such a good story.
I'm a fan of ketchup. Ketchup can be a divisive topic. Some people do not like ketchup. It's a love or hate thing. I think most people love ketchup, but there's a weird minority of people that should be shamed out of our culture for hating ketchup.
Yeah, I do not hate ketchup, for the record.
You're a ketchup lover?
I like it, yeah.
You're on the right side of history with ketchup?
Yeah.
Tim, how do you feel about ketchup?
I like ketchup on limited items.
Oh, really?
Oh, look at this.
Hamburgers, hot dogs, fries. That's probably it.
Huh.
Interesting.
But that's the classic condiment food.
We're going to have to keep a close
eye
on him.
What about ketchup as a sports gel?
Which ultra runners do. They do it.
Really?
They do anything.
Yeah. Oh, I thought I made that up.
You didn't. You made it up, but it's real.
That's glad, right. I brought this up.
Well, it's because it's got sugar, tons of sugar. I mean, it's not really good for you.
Besides the point.
Sugar, salt, easy delivery system, that Heinz bottle, you squeeze it right in your mouth, bam.
Hmm.
It's like a gel.
Question for Gladwell. Would you fuel with ketchup?
You probably would. Gladwell Ultra Runner, yeah. Spraying the ketchup in his mouth.
Oh, it'd be so good.
Speaking of which, we did a story this week about his throwdown, his gauntlet challenge.
Oh, yes.
To NBA superstar LeBron James over racing a mile. Shocker, LeBron James has not responded.
I want
to
it Gladwell's to happen.
Challenge.
I really want it to happen.
Of course, I want it.
I
want to
go there and I want to watch it in person.
Tim, who wins a mile between Malcolm Gladwell and LeBron James?
I think Gladwell would win, but I think LeBron James would go under 5 minutes for the mile.
I think he would surprise a lot of people.
There is a Sports Illustrated had a poll, and I think 10,000 people chimed in, and Gladwell only got it by 2%. It was 52-48. No. A lot about like, well, the video that surfaced of LeBron is.
Oh, him doing that like
he seems like he just seems like a.
Dude's a beast. He's like the ultimate athlete. He's the ultimate athlete. He's like an all-round athlete. He could have played in the NFL, put him on a pair of skates, he would have killed in the NHL. I mean, he's amazing.
Yeah.
And he's probably a pretty damn good, you know, middle-ish distance runner. He's certainly probably not a long-distance runner, but he's a fit dude. I think Gladwell would win.
Yeah. Me too.
That's a fair bet.
Yeah. Tim. What's your recommendation?
For the second week in a row, I'm going to do a life pro tip. This comes from YouTube extraordinaire Casey Neistat, who we've written about extensively. Whenever he does anything running related, we typically write about him. He tweeted a photo, I think it was either last week or the previous week, about swapping out your shoes and kind of having like a three-shoe rotation to let the foam kind of recover between each of your runs. And I found this is... It actually works quite well. I'm going through a pair of Sauconys right now, and I think they have like over 700K on them. And I just kind of only run in them every second or third day. Mostly by chance, not really by plan, but they seem to be like basically the same as they were at 300K. So yeah, just letting them kind of recover in terms of the foam. I think it might even be, I'm sure, the subject of a study where it's the shoes are longer lasting when you kind of give them more than 24 hours to recover, to let the foam, I guess, kind of bounce back.
And it's fun to run in a different pair of shoes on a different day. You get a different feel. Mm-hmm. You can kind of have your easy, comfortable, easy day run shoes. You can have your more aggressive, tempo-y run shoes. I like to run a couple times a year. I like to run like a long run in the marathon shoe I'm going to wear just to kind of get a feel for it. And it kind of gets me psyched up for that run. Usually it's closer to the marathon that I do that, kind of test them out, get into that racing mindset.
I feel like it might like even like work different like sets of muscles just because you're so used to running with certain type of shoes. If you switch it up, maybe the amount of foam, the amount of cushioning, the amount of like structure to them might even kind of change the way like, your foot lands or something. And I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. I think so, probably.
Possibly, yeah. My recommendation this week, two real quick ones. First one was the first thing that came to mind, which is a new shoe that came into the office that we're all testing out right now. It's not a new shoe, but it's a new version of the shoe. It's the Saucony Freedom ISO. It's their sort of newer shoe from the last year or so, with the complete Everrun midsole. And, you know, I liked it when it came into the office. It was like, it's very soft. It's kind of similar to some of the like Adidas. The Boost midsole is somewhat similar to it as well. It's got that kind of like soft, like responsive. It's going to last a really long time. And I liked it. But the new version that they've come out with, which is not really a redesign, but just the uppers are different now. And they've got some casual uppers. And man, they're slick. They look good.
They look cool.
Yeah, super cool. Yeah. I'm really impressed. We're going to do a little video review of them and make sure to get a whole bunch of pictures of the different colorways. And they've got like a suede kind of throwback one. I just really like them. I think they're really, really neat. And I've been wearing them and running them the last few days. And it's like that's a shoe that I don't want to get dirty. And when I don't want to get a shoe dirty, it means I really like it. So that's the one. And then the other is kind of more of a, like a, it's like an obvious thing that so many people do. But I went and did mile repeats last night on a dirt track here in Toronto at Riverdale, and I just ran them with a splits watch. I ran down 20 minute warm up, shook the legs out with the guy that I was doing the workout with, did some strides, didn't really worry about overall distance. It was all about just focusing on doing, I had 4 times a mile. I just stuck to the plan, hit every lap right on schedule. If I ran too fast, backed it off, didn't get greedy. If you ran too slow, you know, push it up a little bit and you just worry about those 4 laps and then 2 laps recovery and do that a bunch of times.
Nice. It's like a good no fuss workout.
Yeah. And then you cool down for 15 or so, 20 minutes and you're done. You don't worry about how far you ran. You don't worry about anything else. You just worry about getting the work done. And I just love I love mile repeats with like a the old Timex splits watch. It's like one of my favorite things to do in running.
Nice. You've inspired me to do that workout.
Yes. It is fun. Yes. And a little bit hard.
Yeah.
I've started doing something similar to that, but I wear a GPS watch on my opposite hand to just record how long I actually go.
Strava.
Yeah. I don't stop it. I don't pay attention to it. I just put it on my weak hand. So and then have the Timex on my my strong hand. So I can actually get the splits, because GPS watches are not very good with splits.
No. Or
they are, but they make a ton of racket and not meant for the short interval type laps.
Another not so pro tip that maybe all of our listeners would be like, yeah, of course. But it's something that's worth doing is when you're doing the warm up, I like to run the opposite direction of the way you're supposed to run on the track, on that far, far outside lane. So you're out of everyone's way. Just takes a lot of stress off of that plant leg, off that left leg. Because otherwise you're going to slowly ruin that left leg of yours.
Amen.
All right.
Cool.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Make sure to subscribe to us on iTunes and Apple Podcast. And we're also now available on Stitcher and Google Play. Make sure to follow our Facebook page at facebook.com/theshakeoutpodcast and on Twitter at @shakeoutpodcast and Instagram @shakeoutpodcast.